everyone, and Happy New Year. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's January 2024, a very new year of the podcast, and you're listening to episode 373, and we're on our way to episode 400. And this is a conversation about social media and scrolling and doom scrolling habits. On this episode, I'm joined by Lisa Cooper, who is a senior copywriter at Revelation Media and a freelance writer with Barna. She has a master's degree in religion from the American Lutheran Theological Seminary. Lisa has written a feature article for the Christian Research Journal, and her article is called A Christian Response to Scrolling and Doom Scrolling. And you can read her article for free online at our website, equip.org. Lisa, it's good to have you on again.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, as I mentioned, today we are discussing social media and specifically that habit that 100% of us with smartphones has, or even computers for that matter, of just scrolling, and then also something called doom scrolling that I will have Lisa get into. But it's just this habit that we have where we mindlessly go onto the internet and we just look at things, whether it be for some people into sports, that could be like going to check all the sports scores and scrolling through all the teams and seeing how they did, or you know, whatever hobby that you have an interest in, you might go to a site and just start going through it. But specifically more on social media, whether it be TikTok or Instagram or Facebook. And it's funny because I read some article in the New York Times where they were talking about generations in social media. And one girl was saying something about, well, the older generations, millennials and Gen X, they don't know how to use social media. We're, you know, we have a really balanced life about it. And then she admitted she spends 8 hours a day on TikTok or something like that. Part of it was for her work. But wow. I mean, it was the most ironic comment ever, which people commented about in the comments section. But it's so easy. We did publish various articles on social media in the past. It's been a while, but it's just so easy for any of us to say, okay, I'm going to just really quick jump on to X site. And before you know it, you look up and 20 minutes has gone by. So what's the difference between scrolling and doom scrolling? Let's just kind of set that out before we dive into the conversation.
Yeah, so they're obviously very related. When you have, as you said, scrolling is just that kind of mindless, you know, you've got your thumb on the screen and you're just kind of scrolling through social media. It can be compulsive, you know, when you kind of forget what you're doing and you get wrapped up in going from one thing to the next. And it can relate to other things other than social media, like you said, when you're dealing with like sports statistics or news sources. If you're reading articles, you can just be kind of scrolling through and not really reading. It tends to be more passive, like you're not actively reading articles, you're just kind of passively engaging with them. Doom scrolling, on the other hand, it has to do with seeking out intentionally negative information. And so while you could be like leisurely scrolling on social media, doom scrolling has to do with, it's more of like an intense version of media intake where you're seeking out negativity. And so it can be like depressing content, negative content. It can be negative confirmation bias content. So if you're upset about something, you're going to find other people that are upset about the same thing. And so the big thing is that it's large amounts of that. So doom scrolling has this kind of inflated and negative connotation to it, hence the doom added to scrolling.
I also think sometimes there might be unintentional doom scrolling. In other words, let's say something major happens, for example, a couple of years ago when there was COVID. So nobody understood it, knew what was going on. So they had probably checked the internet, just have more and more information. And it just started, people started getting really scared and freaked out because they kept seeing, you know, just how devastating this could be, or the number of deaths reported. And so sometimes I think it just might be, oh, I'm interested in this topic, like a war or something going on. You want to get information. And then you get down the rabbit hole and you just read more and more, you know, terrible, scary stories about that topic.
Right. And so actually there's like doom scrolling became a big thing in our culture. It popped up as like a word that people use a lot because of COVID. And you know, it makes a lot of sense when you're evaluating your surroundings for potential threats to want to know all about it. For example, like if you are diagnosed with some kind of disease, you're going to want to look up all the things about it. And if you don't know about it, you're going to want to have all of the information at your disposal. And so that's COVID was the same way, right? Like we all wanted to know what was happening and we wanted to know what the regulations were and what to, you know, how do we clean our groceries and all of the things that went along with that. And COVID also, like with stay-at-home orders, social media interaction skyrocketed. Screen time skyrocketed. There were a bunch of different sociological studies done that showed that screen time just skyrocketed during that time. And so I think COVID really did bring this into national dialogue in a very meaningful way. I think there's also like all of the kind of social unrest that happened because of that too, kind of heightened that already present problem. And so when you start looking at COVID-related content, you'd get more COVID-related content. And it was just a way that we all kind of engaged with social media at the time, for sure.
And that I would also say that, you know, this isn't a conversation about algorithms, but, you know, the algorithms look at what you've looked at and will suggest more content. So it'll keep sending you down that path if you look at a lot of articles or websites on a particular topic. But before we get into just more about doom scrolling and scrolling that we do on our phones and computers, I want to ask you just up front about why this should matter to Christians, because I want people to hang in there for this whole podcast, because I think this is really important. And this does have a component into the Christian life into it as we think about, well, how should Christians interact with technology? So how we spend our time on social media and interacting with people there and interacting with, you know, all of our devices, and maybe in the future with the AI and all these other things that haven't been invented yet technologically. Why should this topic matter? Why should we care about it?
I think it's so easy as people in general just to take whatever's in our lives and at our disposal for granted and say, well, you know, God called us to be stewards of the earth, and, you know, we stewarded all of these things to make technology, and now we have dominion over it, and we can just use it however we want. But in reality, we are called to be in the world, but not of the world. We're called to be thoughtful about how we engage with the things in front of us. And so when technology sort of gets a blanket approval by our culture, I think we need to be thoughtful about that. So when we think about like fruits of the spirit, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. I feel like a lot of us have memorized that as as like little kids, you know? Those are all things that we're supposed to be striving for. And when you look at how technology has shifted our focus from a lot of those things, right after the fruits of the spirit in that passage in Galatians, Paul says to not become conceited, provoking one another or envying one another. And it's so funny to me how those three things are the things people do on social media the most. So, you know, we become conceited when, you know, our timelines are us, you know, posting pictures of ourselves or looking for approval from people, provoking one another. I mean, have you spent any time on Twitter or X now it's called? Provoking one another seems to be some of people's favorite pastimes online in general, posting provocative articles and trying to pick a fight with people. I think, especially with a lot of cultural conversations being so polarized right now, people really do spend a lot of time provoking one another. And then obviously, envy becomes a big deal when you see people whose lives maybe look on the surface or on social media, you know, better than yours, or they have things that you want. It's really easy to fall into comparison and envy. And so I think when we as Christians are learning to engage with technology that can be really useful for so many things. I mean, I got my job on Twitter, when it was Twitter. And, you know, I've made connections with people that way. And I met you on social media. I think it was through a Facebook group. So there are so many like wonderful things that can happen because of social media. But if we don't keep ourselves in check with Holy Scripture, I think we can lose sight of the things that are really important. And so there's this great quote from, oh my goodness, I can't remember his name off the top of my head. He is one of the Christian Research Journal writers that I quoted in my piece. He talks about how social media is an overexposure of the underdeveloped self. And so
Kyle Keating, that's who the author is.
Yeah, yeah. And so we have this underdeveloped self trying to be like promoted on social media. And so I think as Christians, we have to be very aware of that temptation and guard ourselves against gossip and narcissism and immodesty and exchanging real life relationships for digital ones. And, you know, if we're called to walk in a manner worthy of the Lord, as, you know, Paul writes in Colossians, I think we really need to be careful about how we engage with these things and use them as technology, especially like interactive media. When we're engaging with our phones and stuff, I think we have a particular ability to fall into some of these like addictive patterns and things and lose sight of who our neighbor is. And that I think is really bad and very important to be aware of.
And I also think that we tend to forget because it seems so present, in other words, as real to us sometimes as embodied relationships. But the Bible really calls us to have embodied community. I think that's another point in Kyle's article. And I think the temptation of social media is to not have embodied community. We have had articles on this, but another thing would be, it causes people to say, well, I don't need to go to church in person. It's just easier for me to stream church because I don't have to deal with any of the unpleasant people that I don't like at church, except for we are leaving out all the actual commands in the New Testament for the body of Christ to one another. And we can't, you know, love one another, exhort one another, you know, weep with one another, rejoice, if we don't know people in an embodied fashion. Some of those things can only happen in the context of embodied relationships one-to-one.
Absolutely. And I think the fact that there are so many positive ways that we can use technology to foster those relationships is a wonderful thing. But you do really have to care deeply about people. And I think pursuing those relationships in real life, like face-to-face, I think technology can be something that bolsters that, but it's harder to do it when you don't have that relationship already established in real life.
Well, this is one last aside on this topic and this conversation thread, and that is, I don't know if a lot of people listening have done Zoom meetings, and Zoom meetings are fine, but I'm finding that even in a Christian context, when you're doing a Bible study on Zoom, I'm doing something like that with some international people, it's just not as... I don't know. It's not as robust as if we were meeting together. It's harder to, you know, do discussion as opposed to if I was sitting in a room with women, you know, in a small group. So I think we can see that sometimes when a lot of us have had a ton of Zoom meetings for work and other contexts, but there can be some shortcomings from trying to do all of our relational things as people in the church just through mediated technology.
Right. I was doing full-time college ministry when the pandemic hit. And so all of my Bible studies that I was running with college students all became Zoom Bible studies. And it was fascinating to see the same groups of women that I was working with in person, like just a few weeks before, see them kind of transform into a community on the internet. And like, I think you're totally right. You just don't, people kind of shut down. There's that barrier there kind of being refracted through technology, and people weren't as engaged. They didn't open up as much. There were some people who were very socially nervous, I think, in real life that maybe opened up more on Zoom. But I would say that that was very much the exception to the rule. I think, yeah, it was very odd. I think you're totally right, though.
Happy New Year again to you and yours. And if you missed it, please check your podcast feed because a few days ago, we released an encore edition of episode 268, which is almost 100 episodes ago. And this episode, I had a conversation with Anne Kennedy, who's a regular guest on this podcast, and we talked about if Christians should make New Year's resolutions, and if they should, what kind should there be? Plus, are there any guiding biblical principles that might inform and shape making New Year's resolutions? So if you're thinking about them, you might want to give this encore episode a try. And yes, it is a new year, and we would love for you to help us get the word out about this podcast. And I really want to thank Boot Another because this person gave us a rating and most importantly, gave us an in-depth sentence or two talking about why they listen to the podcast. And it really helps us out on the algorithm if you do that. So thanks a lot, Boot Another. And we would like to see your handle up there on Apple Podcasts. So head on over to Apple Podcasts. Really, it only takes a few moments of your time. All this content is free. We hope you enjoy it. And we hope you would do us a big favor and rate and review the podcast. Well, back to the conversation with Lisa Cooper.
Well, just in some of the comments, we were just talking about different ways social media impacts community and those kinds of things. Do you think we can rightly describe social media as addictive?
It's so, this question is so interesting to me. And I spend a lot of time on it in the article that I wrote. I think when we talk about addiction, sometimes we'll kind of use it very flippantly, like, you know, I'm addicted to cookies or this TV show. But when we're talking about like addiction in the proper sense, that like as we would with substance abuse, where there's like actually a change happening in your brain and the desire is for that change that happens in your brain when you're engaging with something, it seems pretty unanimous from social scientists that you can use addiction language with social media and with scrolling and doom scrolling. And so, for example, like one of the things that's brought up over and over again is this thing called intermittent reinforcement, as like you get with a slot machine where you are, let's say, scrolling on social media and that kind of serotonin hit that you get when you're when you see something that is exciting or encouraging or feeling connected to other people. You know, there's lights and sounds and videos and all of these things that are like reward feelings when you're scrolling on social media. And because of the For You pages and because of the algorithms that are present on social media, those rewards that we feel in our brains, you know, are kind of tailored to us specifically. And so we feel persuaded, you know, from these algorithms to continue. And so social media platforms have really capitalized on that feeling we want with connection with others. And there's this, you know, when you scroll online, you may feel more connected to other people. And so as you do that, as you scroll, your brain actually releases oxytocin, which in turn releases dopamine. And so it makes those connections that we feel when we're scrolling feel good. And so we actually have like a chemical reaction happening in our brains when we feel the benefits of feeling connected on social media. There's like novelty with it. And I think with all of the lights and sounds and videos and catchy, specifically tailored content for us and lots of it, there's so much quantity of these things. It becomes this like kind of drug that you have when you're scrolling. And you know, in the book My Tech-Wise Life by Amy Crouch, and her dad, Andy Crouch, actually wrote pieces of that book too. But in this section written by Amy, she talks about like how what people want in relationships is not what they choose. So they want to be in person with friends, but they end up choosing to text them instead. And so those pathways of connection that they're forming with people are actually like the opposite of what they really want. And so that seems to be the behavior of an addicted person, right? When you choose the thing that you know is not really what you want because it makes you feel good, and you're missing out on the real life connection. And so I think when we use the word addiction related to social media and scrolling and doom scrolling and all these things, there is actually like a chemical reaction happening in our brains that we desire to continue to have that makes us want to continue doing this. And so it's not just a behavioral modification thing. It's also, you have to take into account that there's actually something happening that draws you to your device over and over again. And it can be a harder habit to break for that reason.
You talked about the algorithm. I think it's really interesting that sometimes we'll get complaints from people about our YouTube channel that there might be inappropriate ads, except for the algorithm shows people ads based on what they're already looking at. So we kind of say, we don't pick the ads, and what you see is based on behaviors that someone, you or someone else, is using your computer, you know? So I find that fascinating.
Yeah.
Maybe some people don't realize that.
Exactly. Like all the people who complain about all the ads on Twitter, it's the same thing.
Yeah, this is inappropriate. It's like, well, somebody's looking at inappropriate stuff, and maybe it's not you, somebody impersonating you on your computer. But one thing is, it seems to me that social media companies and, of course, news organizations have capitalized on the addictive nature of scrolling and doom scrolling. And actually, the Christian Research Institute, we try to subscribe to different news organizations that are covering things, even though we might not agree with their point of view. For example, we subscribe to the New York Times to keep up on just different research and different trends that we would definitely not know about that they bring to our attention that we end up covering in the journal, especially cultural trends or trends dealing with marriage and sexuality. But recently they sent out a survey. So I got a survey, you know, to my address about the New York Times, and just going through it, I could tell all the questions were so leading. They were just like, do you think, you know, our apps help you be a better person if you have this coverage? I'm thinking, no. You know, so it's really interesting how they're trying to find out their readers and what they're doing and how they would want to interact with their apps and their websites. And the other thing too, I find really interesting is as new social media platforms have been created. So remember, before Instagram was just pictures, but now it's all these videos because everyone got into TikTok. And before TikTok, it was Snapchat, and then videos that disappeared and things that were only 60 seconds. And actually, I was thinking to myself recently, because all of us have different interests on social media. One of my interests is cooking. And so I save recipes and things like that on Instagram. That's what's shown in my feed, various recipes. And I was thinking to myself the other day, like, who is watching the Food Network? Because if you cannot show me a recipe in 30 to 45 seconds, like, I'm out. Like, I wouldn't watch from half an hour thing, because it's like taking too long. And sometimes even if it goes all the way to the 55 or 60 seconds, I'm like, this is a long recipe. I mean, I'm expecting them to show me how to cook something in 30 seconds. So what do you think of, you know, do you think that's happening as they look at our behaviors and know that we're scrolling and doom scrolling?
It's so funny because I am also interested in cooking content on the internet. You know, I love that stuff, but I tend to consume that content on YouTube, which is a much longer format than TikTok or Instagram Reels or any of that, or TikTok or whatever. And so when I'm recommended things, they tend to be longer, but that's just the thing. Like, it's tailored specifically to your tastes on the platforms you use. And so I think part of it is that the For You pages that we have online, and this is actually something I didn't get to talk about in my article that I found really interesting, is that there are actually some pieces of law that have been brought up recently. I know that there's one in New York State and I believe Utah, actually late October of this year, New York State brought a bill forward that it's trying to make the algorithm-based personalized social media feeds, like the ones that you get on TikTok or Instagram or Facebook or YouTube, it's trying to make them go away for kids. And so anybody under 18, they would like get rid of these for you pages. And parents would actually have the ability to limit the number of hours that children can spend on the apps too. So you wouldn't have people spending, you know, 8 hours on TikTok. It was Utah. Utah in March, they passed a bill that required parents to consent to children under age 18 to make social media accounts. And so even our legislatures, all of these people who are creating bills surrounding this stuff are concerned that this is a problem. These For You pages are really playing into this addictive nature of social media. And they're finding that, especially in younger populations, that social media creates feelings of depression and anxiety at such a higher level that people who are passing bills actually feel like they need to make statements about it and who are representing the public. And so I think this sort of increased screen time, access to social media, all of the problems that can come through social media and affect younger people, getting people into all kinds of trouble at younger ages when they don't really know how to engage well with these platforms, they're like, we're actually taking steps to solve some of those problems, which I think is interesting. But I think the shock value stuff especially, and I think there are differences across generations here. Boomers tend to be on Facebook, and so they tend to be, I don't know, more persuaded by the inflammatory headlines that come up on Facebook and the fake news sites that pop up, all those like clickable links that take you away from Facebook and onto sites where you are going to get mad because, you know, you're reading content that's not necessarily true or accurately representing things. And then people on Instagram, millennials are mostly on Instagram and they're, you know, getting their information from those like slide deck picture images that pop up. You know, people design something pretty and say whatever they want on a pretty background and people believe it. And without sources cited, and, you know, that's a problem. And then Gen Z tends to be on TikTok. And so they're the ones who tend to go for that like video, very short content, and they don't like the longer form content. It's just interesting. I think because it's so personally tailored, they can really like get at what drives you to keep moving and keep using the app.
What I thought was interesting, you were talking about the bill for children, is this is a long time ago, but the New York Times back in 2011, so October of 2011, it's almost 12 years ago, ran a story about how there was a school in Silicon Valley where all the big tech officer executives, you know, eBay, Google, Apple, Yahoo, those kinds of things at the time, I don't know, is Yahoo still around? They sent their kids to a very exclusive school, and there was zero screens. There was no screens, no computers. They just did pen and paper, and they did, you know, different things like helping them learn how to knit and different things that were just all low tech. And so I think it's fascinating because it seems to me that somehow the people creating this stuff that we're addicted to in all of our phones and those kinds of things, they realize that and they don't want their children to have anything to do with it. So they send them to school without computers. Meanwhile, so many people are at, and that was 12 years ago. So even more so now. So I find that really fascinating.
And they would know, right? Those are the people that know how detrimental this stuff can be.
Oh, yes. Both of my sons are, well, one actually does work in Silicon Valley, but they're both, one's in college, computer science majors. And I find it interesting. My youngest son, he has no social media whatsoever. So, and you know, he knows how all this stuff works. He's a computer coder, but I think some of the people creating it understand how it's working on everyone else, perhaps. Although, you know, when all your friends have it, and that's how they communicate. You know, you're the person that doesn't have it. But one thing that you mentioned is something called problematic interactive media use, PIMU. And so this kind of label that's given to people who have that, what kinds of people are most at risk for problematic interactive media use? And tell our listeners, what are some of the signs that they can recognize either in themselves, if they can be self-reflective and self-aware, or people that they know, whether it's teenagers or a spouse or a roommate that might be in this category?
Yeah. So I brought up problematic interactive media use, or PIMU. I've only ever seen it written, so I don't know if we can call it PMU or like, I don't know, but I bring this up in my article because there is, it's sort of a more expansive term for what we're talking about when we talk about this kind of addictive nature of scrolling and doom scrolling. So it includes some extra things, but it also includes those things. So it would also include things like online gambling, online gaming, other kinds of like internet sort of addictions like pornography, and it includes, you know, scrolling on and doom scrolling on the internet. And so problematic interactive media use has to do with, you know, when you have a touchscreen phone, you know, you're interacting with the media that you have, like you're moving your hands to interact with it. And so basically this particular problem, it contributes to like a functional impairment. So if you are participating in uncontrolled use of interactive screen media, whether it be, you know, gaming or any of these other things, basically it results in negative consequences so that affect your functioning. So you could have like withdrawal-like symptoms that kind of mimic substance abuse withdrawal. And I know people kind of joke about this a lot. You know, if you're getting together with your family for Thanksgiving and you all put your phones in the other room and you say like, you know, no phones at the dinner table or whatever. And you see people kind of like reaching for their phones throughout the meal, like people joke about, oh, you know, I'm just addicted to my phone. And it may actually be kind of true, but for people with problematic interactive media use issues, that would be overwhelming. You know, it would feel more like a substance withdrawal. It causes, you know, depression. It causes all kinds of like anxiety that you wouldn't otherwise have because it's taking away the thing that brings that immediate gratification. And I think we especially see this with like online gaming. You know, I had a friend at one point in my life who got so addicted to World of Warcraft that he stopped talking to everybody and got sucked into playing the game all the time and would miss school and stay up all night. And I think we all have seen people who have done things like this, but it actually, it kind of coexists with people who tend to have pre-existing anxiety, you know, sleep disorders, people who tend to be on the autism spectrum, other people who tend to struggle with excessive media use in general. And so those are kind of like red flags that something might be up if you see people who already have those problems starting to become functionally impaired because of their media use. But what I found fascinating about this whole thing is that the risk factors pit, like the biggest one is being male. And, you know, I know some women who tend to be on their phones a lot, but the statistics from the sociologists say that being male, some studies say it's, you know, 2 to 3 to 5 times more likely that you're going to struggle with this particular condition than women. So I think that that's a big deal. I have two boys who are, you know, almost 9 and 11. They'll be 9 and 11 next month. And so I am thinking about, you know, they're playing some video games every once in a while. They like playing, you know, Mario and all of those things. And, you know, it's scary to think about that they have like so much more of a likelihood to become addicted in a way that functionally impairs them than girls the same age. And so some of the other things are like lower socioeconomic status, being in a single parent household. And as you get older, as like a teen, like older teens, tend to have more of a likelihood of developing PIMU. So anybody who has like, who tends toward like being impulsive, don't have like great self-control, high levels of urgency, all of those things can contribute to it. But that's sort of like a catch-all to say this is a bigger problem than just zooming in on just scrolling and doom scrolling, because this interactive media that we have is so all-consuming and can be like, can actually impair your ability to function in regular society. And so just being aware that, you know, if you have young kids, like I do, like I have to think about how am I discipling my children regarding technology to help them not develop these problems? How do we teach, you know, temperance and like engaging things in a way that is helpful and not harmful?
And I think for Christians too, even if, you know, there's the stereotype, right, of the guy in his parents' basement or whatever.
Yes.
He graduates from college and is just down there playing video games and eating snacks all day or something like that. Although I don't want to take that lightly, because I know somebody that exactly happened to their kid. They graduated from high school and basically, as far as I can know, and he's closer to 30 than 20, he just plays video games in his parents' house. But so there is that. But even if someone, you know, did play video games and, you know, didn't have an issue. In other words, they played video games a lot, but they got good grades and they, you know, played on the soccer team and all this stuff. I think as Christians, we still have to evaluate how much time do we want to put into being online, whether it's a social media site or just being online like you were talking about. Let's say you got a bad disease. In fact, I remember reading a Johnny Erickson Tada book on suffering, and she said, one thing, you know, try to, if you get a diagnosis, yes, go and find it, but then don't let your diagnosis define you. Don't go down that rabbit hole where you have to study everything about the diagnosis and know everything, where you're just so all consumed that you lose sight of being a Christian in the community of God type of thing. So I just think that there is, you know, let's say you're not addicted, but how do we evaluate how we should spend time, even a lot of time online?
Right. And that kind of circles back to just being aware of like, what are we focusing our minds on as Christians? Like being in the world, but not of the world. If we're spending all of our time online or playing games, is that really the best way to love and serve our neighbor?
So what are some practical ways that, just thinking about that, loving and serving our neighbors and our families and our communities, like, so how can people step away from scrolling or even doom scrolling, which could be like you mentioned, it could be fine to know something about a disease, but then you start getting paranoid about everything because you've read so much and this person didn't respond to this or treatment or whatever, and actually engage with, you know, social media in a better way than just the mindless scrolling.
Yeah.
And then, or, you know, down the rabbit hole, what you said for you, like, oh, I watched this one video on this famous baseball player. Then it suggested me all these other ones. Because I think it's interesting. Sometimes we get comments on our YouTube video and there, someone will say like, how did I even get here? Like, I don't know anything about, and I'm here at this video. I guess YouTube suggested it to me. I mean, we actually have gotten that comment before. So, you know, people are scrolling and getting suggested and here they are. And so how can we practically not get pulled in by the scrolling and doom scrolling, but not say, okay, we're going to be a Luddite and get rid of all social media and all devices.
Right. So I think there are lots of really good ways. And I wish I, you know, if I had written a whole lot more, I could have gotten into a bunch of things. But I think there are these great little books by, you know, Andy Crouch and Amy Crouch that talk about, you know, my TechWise life and the TechWise family. Those are the two books. And they do a really good job of outlining some principles about how do you use technology to cultivate virtue in your family and not just use it as a tool to, you know, just mindlessly engage with whatever content is put in front of you. And so part of that is making technology part of a family environment. You know, you're not just on your phone by yourself, but you're you know, you're looking things up together, you're having a conversation and you're engaging together about, you know, looking something up and finding answers to things or watching videos together or something. I think placing technology in its rightful place is a big deal. And so we may need to kind of like reprogram our brains that social media is, it can be good. It can help us to see the needs of others. It's great for keeping up with old friends. It's great for making new connections with people. But I think if we cultivate virtue in our lives and in ourselves, and we look at all of the things put in front of us, we can like participate in reading on the internet in a way that is not flippant and mindless. And I talk a lot about like how there's this pull to be like, I just want to relax, or I just want to be mindless for a while. And I'm guilty of this. This is something I do, you know, in the mornings. There's like there's a half hour time period where my husband is driving my kids to school. And so I get up, I make lunches and stuff, and my kids get in the car with my husband and they drive to school. And by the time he gets back, it's been a half hour. And so in that half hour, I drink my coffee and I scroll on my phone. Is that the best use of my time? Probably not. But it's nice to just have a minute to just kind of like be mindless before I have to start my long day of work and kids and all of the different commitments that I have. And so one of the things we need to like keep in mind is that if we're using technology and we're thinking about using it to cultivate virtue, like we have to think about what pleasure is and like how kind of is misplaced in our culture. Is being mindless actually a pleasurable thing? I don't know. I think we have to kind of wrestle with that. This is something I need to think about, clearly. But I also think that like reprogramming our brains to like go slower when we're engaging with content, maybe read things a second time instead of being angry or immediately responding to something, that makes it so we can maybe avoid some misunderstandings with friends and family that we're engaging with on the internet, or even like strangers on the internet. I think about engaging with strangers a lot on the internet because I do use Twitter, X, whatever. You know, people come out of the woodwork and yell at you for not saying something in a tweet. But is that necessary? Like, is that a good use of your time? I don't think so. So yeah, when we're I think being mindful, being calculated, being careful, and kind of putting technology in its proper place, thinking like, how is this cultivating virtue in my life? Is this cultivating virtue in my life? And if it's not, maybe reevaluating what you're doing with your time.
This is just a practical idea for some people. If you know that you can tend to go down the hole, like, oh, I'm only going to be on social media for 20 minutes and you look up and 45 minutes has gone by, maybe you want to set a timer. Like, I'm going to go check my different social media sites. And even if it's a longer format like YouTube, but once my timer goes off in 20 minutes, I close it down. And so maybe that's something people can think about. And it's not the purview of this particular article, but some of these principles can also apply to binge watching. I don't think binge watching existed before certain internet apps. I mean, back in the old days, Netflix, you'd have to, you know, order a DVD through the mail. So you couldn't binge watch. But now that things are on, you know, whole series and whole television shows from like the 90s who have, you know, 300 episodes up there, you can just go from one episode to the next episode. And in the old days, you know, people had to wait for the whole week to watch the next episode. So I just think that people just need to be careful of that. Otherwise, they can go down the rabbit hole of binge watching. And I've heard stories about that. Oh, we're going to watch this series this weekend. I mean, sometimes intentional binge watching. You know, my husband and I want to catch up because it's going to be the finale of X show coming on. And we just started binge watching and they started a Friday night and they just go all the way through the weekend. So you just have to think about, how am I, you know, spending my time, especially particularly for Christians, although it's true for everyone. I do want to ask you specifically about a book that you quoted, because I think that is interesting in terms of thinking about what ways in which we could do something that's an alternative to scrolling and doom scrolling. And you quote the book on Reading Well by Karen Swallow Pryor. Ironically, I met her online as well, but
me too.
I've actually met her in real life.
Me too.
in face-to-face social situations and meetings with Karen. So I do know her personally in real life too, not just I met her online. But how does her book, Reading, and the idea of reading well, help us as Christians navigate online media content without getting just pulled into this, you know, either the mindless scrolling or the doom scrolling, which can produce a lot of anxiety in us?
Yeah, actually, the doom scrolling, it says that if you like, one of the studies I was reading said that if you spend 2 minutes looking at negative online content, it can affect your feelings of well-being. And so I think when we talk about, I mentioned On Reading Well, and obviously that book is, it's fabulous, but it's more geared toward like literature and careful reading of literature. But I do think that there is like a principle. When I talk about cultivating virtue with how we engage with things, I think when we're looking at, you know, online news articles or reading updates from friends, all of those like even little bits of reading that we do throughout the day that come with online engagement can be done in a way that promotes reading well and promotes virtue. And so there's, you know, we can... When the internet is at its best, when social media is at its best, we're getting maybe spiritual insight from people. Maybe we're meeting cool people like Dr. Karen Swallow Pryor, like because we met her on the internet, you know? Maybe we're being informed of current events. Maybe like we're getting important context for ministry or for life or updates on friends and maybe their needs if there is something that pops up that they need. But when we slow down and read with an eye toward virtue and reading, putting the best construction on what people are saying, trying to understand where they're coming from, trying to do our best to not be so like flippant with how we engage, that's all very useful. So the quote that I think is so like, there are two that I think I quoted from her in my paper. But she says, reading virtuously means first, reading closely, being faithful to both text and context, interpreting accurately and insightfully, the attentiveness necessary for deep reading, the kind of reading we practice in reading literary works as opposed to skimming news stories or reading instructions requires patience. The skills of interpretation and evaluation require prudence. Even the simple decision to set aside time to read in a world rife with so many other choices competing for our attention requires a kind of temperance. And so we have all of these ways that we need to exercise virtue in reading. And I think patience is the biggest one when we're looking at online sources. And so if we spend time and take a step back, you know, I do read a lot of articles on the internet. That's probably where I spend a lot of my time. And they're often like, you know, I'm working on a project. I'm reading about scrolling and doom scrolling, or I'm reading about the fertility industry, or I'm reading about all of these different things. And if you slow down and really like think about what you're reading rather than just breezing through and not really paying attention and getting mad, I think that's where patience makes a big difference. And I think we also like when we read well, we can be discerning. Dr. Pryor says that she like it helps us understand what visions for life are false and which ones are true. And that can be one of the most foundational things when you're dealing with like the scrolling and doom scrolling kind of addictive pull, is recognizing the difference between what's true and what's false and which ones are good and which ones are bad. And I don't want to be pulled into just negativity and only what's bad. I want to also have a vision for life and engaging with other people that's positive. And that way, like, it promotes real better things, you know, not just negativity.
So I'd like you to give us some practical ways that we can minimize our scrolling and doom scrolling, or even give it up altogether. Because I'll have to say, in regards to doom scrolling, like you were talking about, you had to be online for work. And a lot of times I do too. I mean, I have to spend time researching things or doing some, you know, reading up of other things that writers have linked to make sure that that's, you know, correct and the right quote and all these things. So you're, you know, and then you have to read it in context. But I just think that it can cause us, even if we do research, to just feel like after it, you know, you want to take a shower. Earlier this year, I don't want to name it because I think there's a controversy almost every month that you can point to and people make memes about in any kind of space or sphere, but particularly also, and it's not immune from Christianity, but there got to be such a huge brouhaha over something, which we ended up dealing with and covering many months later. So after the dust had settled, we published our review of a particular book that was being critiqued early in the year, and our review didn't come out until almost June. But just spending a whole day trying to keep up with everyone's points and counterpoints on X, and then reading everybody blogging about it, it just got to be this heavy weight. I was just like, literally, I'm like, this is I already knew it was going to be a dumpster fire, but I literally want to take a shower after this. It was so discouraging because you saw people, and it was kind of a pile on because people from both sides of the Christian aisle, both progressive and extremely conservative, were having a lot of critiques about this particular book and the fallout from it. And I just think, you know, the world is watching us because Twitter/X is public and they could see this, and it was ended up getting some, you know, national coverage. And so it was just the worst of everything, gaslighting and canceling. And not that, you know, we did two articles on this particular book and it did, our approach ended up to be very pointed critiques. But I would say, you know, even for us who have to do it for a living, we have to certainly put limits on it and be aware of it because it can be overwhelming at times. And so what are some practical ways to help us, even for people like you and me who have to do it as part of our jobs?
Right. I'm on the internet a lot for all of the things that I do. And so it is something I think about often. One of the practical things that I do is I don't have social media up when I'm working. And actually, some of the articles that I've read have said that, you know, the time suck of social media for people who work from home is really, really, really significant. And because people will get on their computer and just do that instead of working. So I'll only check that stuff like when I'm making my coffee, you know, or my tea in the middle of the day, or I'm on my lunch break or something. But I think just being aware that these practices are not necessarily good for you. It's not good to not be working because you're technically like stealing your company's money, right? You're not actually working for your wages. That's not good. Don't do that. So I think it starts with creating like a realistic plan that you think you're going to do. And I say the same thing, you know, about Bible reading. Don't think of something completely unrealistic. Don't be like, I'm never going to touch my phone again. Or just like I would say, like, I'm going to read the Bible every day at this time. I think it's easier if you start with something that's realistic that you're going to actually do. So like until it forms a habit. So mine is, you know, I'm on Do Not Disturb unless I'm taking a break. And that helps. I think there are all kinds of like studies that have been done that show how working with our hands actually is something that helps people feel less anxious and less depressed. And so I think the fact that when we use interactive media, we're using our hands all the time, right? I'm clicking on things, I'm scrolling on things, I'm doing things with my hands to interact with the internet in front of me. I think using that energy in picking up some other kind of thing that you like to do with your hands, you know, gardening. I'm a big crocheter. I really enjoy crocheting. So I'll listen to audiobooks and crochet in the evenings now instead of scrolling on my phone. That's been a really good swap for me. You love cooking. Cooking is a great thing to do that you can work with your hands and feel like you've accomplished something. There's like a clear beginning and end, which I think is really satisfying for people. Any kind of like music or, you know, I put yo-yoing in my thing. My kids are really into yo-yoing because my husband is a yo-yoer. But it's just a fun thing to do that keeps your hands occupied, keeps your brain engaged, and is not something that you're mindlessly doing. And I do think that, like, even just having, practically speaking, having the conviction as Christians that we have something better to look forward to in eternity with Jesus, that we're not going to be stuck in this doom and gloom world forever. When we get sucked into these feelings of despair that we get when we're scrolling and seeing the negativity and seeing people disappoint us on the internet, people that we otherwise respect saying terrible things on the internet, or just constant scary health news or scary, you know, war updates. I think it does help to take that step back and say, no, like, my eternity is secure. I believe in Jesus and I'm going to be with him forever. And I do think that that can help curb that desire to be so negative and to, you know, you gotta get out of the negative sometimes and think about some of the positive stuff.
And I don't want people to think, oh, we're just here bashing on technology in general, because technology, it's not just electronic, right? I mean, books are technology. There didn't used to be books widely available before the printing press. And, you know, before somebody fashioned a spoon, you know, spoon is technology. So I don't want to say, oh, anti-technology. I mean, there's some, so are there good things about scrolling? Obviously, there's nothing good about doom scrolling, but is there good things about scrolling or social media? I would say that for me, before the dawn of social media, as a matter of fact, I heard about Facebook for the first time, I think, when it was invented, and it was only for college students. I heard about it on NPR, and I thought, oh, that sounds really interesting. Like, you can connect with people you know in your area, or maybe people that you used to know, that kind of thing. I just thought it was kind of interesting. Oh, but it's only for college students, so, you know, adults can't do it. So I think there have been good things. Obviously, you and I've met a lot of our writers, particularly the Christian Research Journal used to just basically very, very few women writers that we'd published. I just don't know how we would have connected to them. But as the years have gone by, in the last 5 years, we have had a significant increase in female writers. And I want to say the majority of them I met online. And so there are some good things, because some of these people I wouldn't meet because they don't live in my area. They don't live where CRI is located, in North Carolina. So it's a way that you can connect to all kinds of people literally around the world. But let's not end on, I guess, a doom note. Is there something positive about this at all? Because some people would just say, write us off and say, you're just trying to be anti-technology. I think our approach here is trying to be one of balance.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And that's why I think, like, I feel like I have been very open on the internet about how helpful the internet has been in connecting me to people. And, you know, when I had my first son and we moved to rural Iowa for my husband's first call to ministry, I lived like in the middle of cows and corn. There was nothing around, and really super lonely, brand new baby. Connecting with people on the internet was a huge deal. And that's actually how I met my younger son's godparents. And I've met a lot of friends on the internet, and I've gotten a lot of opportunities I wouldn't have otherwise gotten for writing and for editing and for all of these cool things. I think when you can seek out community of like-minded people on the internet, it is a really valuable and very cool thing. So I tend to run in the circles of, like, you know, online Christians. I know a lot of online Christians, and it's been such a joy to meet those people in real life, because when those relationships that start online actually move into real life friendships, there's something really cool about that. And social media has helped me keep in contact with people that I did know in real life, and now I see them on the internet more. So I think it can really help mitigate feelings of loneliness. It can help drive connections on specific topics or interests, or, you know, I've hired people to work with me over the years because of the internet. And so I think there are really cool, really great uses for it, for sure. It's that, like, that involves some active engagement rather than passive scrolling. And that's, I think, the biggest difference, is that whether you're active or you're just passive in your engagement, and whether you're putting it in the right priority order in your life, I guess.
And honestly, before YouTube, the average person didn't know how to do a lot of things, that like plumbing issues or whatever. I mean, I think for anything now, we would say, have you looked it up on YouTube? I mean, it'll show you how to do whatever you need to have done. Change your phone battery, or just, you know, cook this thing or make this thing. So I think there have been some positive applications, and, you know, now you don't have to. I know some people who fix their cars from watching stuff on YouTube, and then they didn't have to take it into the shop. So I think there are some things that have been helpful. Well, on a much lighter note to end this podcast, I have a fun question for Lisa. Lisa, it's January, so the whole year is ahead of us. What one word do you hope will describe your 2024?
Ooh, oh my goodness. These word things are never something I'm great at because I love words too much. I want to pick all of them. I think, how about hope? Hope is a good one.
That is a good one. I'd love for my 2024 to be hopeful. Well, thank you, Lisa, for being a guest again on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Yeah, thank you.
You've been listening to episode 373 of the Postmodern Realities podcast. Today's guest was Lisa Cooper, and we've been talking about a Christian response to scrolling and doom scrolling. She has written an online feature article for the Christian Research Journal, and it is called A Christian Response to Scrolling and Doom Scrolling. And you can read her article for free online at our website, equip.org. Stay connected with the Christian Research Institute and all the new content we have coming your way. The best way to do that is to head on over to our website, equip.org. There you will find thousands of free resources right at your fingertips, from articles to video to audio, and it's all for free. You'll find our podcasts hosted there, as well as the Bible Answer Man broadcast, which is hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and streams live every Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. In addition, you don't want to miss out on subscribing to Hank Unplugged, which is the podcast of Hank Hanegraaff. And in that podcast, he has really in-depth, free-flowing, essential Christian conversations with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people. And in addition, he has a new series on his podcast feed called Hank Unplugged Shorts, which Hank goes into the headlines in the mainstream media and refutes a lot of those cultural issues that we have in these short podcast episodes. And there's quite a few of them. You don't want to miss out on them. Now, if you want to find some of this at other places where it's all in one place, really subscribe to our YouTube channel. It's a great way to get all of our content there, our podcasts there, and different individual questions theologically that people have that Hank answers at our YouTube channel. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, I don't know how to subscribe to YouTube. I don't have a YouTube account. Well, actually, you might just have a YouTube account. If you have a Gmail address, you have a YouTube account. Just log into YouTube with your Gmail address and search for Bible Answer Man channel, and please become one of our subscribers. In addition, if you see that bell icon right there on our front page, please click that, and every time that we have new content, you will receive a notification that new content is up on our channel for you to be able to consume. So thank you so much for the ways in which you partner with the Christian Research Institute. We are grateful for you listening and reading and watching.